You're listening to Climate Champions, a podcast from the Architects Journal. I'm Hattie Hartman, sustainability editor at the Architects Journal.
And I'm Hattie's co-host, Joe Jack Williams, a partner at Field & Clegg Bradley Studios.
I think it is important for us all to gain a bit more intuition as to the things that impact on embodied carbon. So if we start to hear about a high temperature process, that should give us an indication that there's going to be high emissions associated, because that will generally mean fossil fuels. To use the analogy with the chef, as designers we need to understand far more about where our materials, our ingredients come from. Brick is no different.
Our guest today is David Watson, a technical director at Structural Engineers AKT2, where he co-leads on all matters related to climate action. David has a particular focus on adaptive reuse, material efficiency, i.e. use less, material innovation, and production systems. He is the author of a fantastic chapter on brick in our materials book, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Bricks and More. Over the years, David has taught at a number of universities in the UK, Ireland, Sweden, and America. He is currently co-teaching a seminar at the Harvard Graduate School of Design with AKT2 co-founder Hanif Kara on material cycles, investigating existing systems of material production and looking ahead to low-carbon alternatives and the role of reuse. David, you have a remarkably light digital footprint. I couldn't even find you on LinkedIn. Perhaps this explains how you managed to crank out your chapter on brick in remarkably short order. In this conversation, we're going to start by talking mostly about brick, but since we're lucky enough to have you on the podcast today, we're also going to ask you some more wide-ranging questions about how you see construction evolving under the impact of a changing climate. So brick is one of a suite of materials available to a designer. Why do we continue to use brick, and why are bricks so pervasive in construction in the UK?
Hi, Hattie, and thanks first for having me on the podcast. So why are bricks so pervasive and enduring? It's a really good question, and it even finds its way into language. I was recalling how when I was younger, growing up in the north of England, I remember people using the term "you're a brick" as this term of endearment, trust and reliability. So it even finds its way into language. I think the association with brick and our relationship with it really begins in earnest at scale during the Victorian age, when we had access to plentiful, energy-dense fuels. And so through the Victorian age, the move from small-scale brick production that would be really done locally at a site, it moved from that small-scale production on site to industrialized production at large scale. And so we see then the emergence of large brickworks. So it's really been with us for a long time, and longer than some of the other common conventional, shall we say, building materials that we see now, concrete and steel, and is often used in the facades of buildings. So it's very, very visible in a way that maybe some of the other materials are not.
Yeah, it's that kind of industrialization of construction materials. Is this the kind of start of our disconnect from where buildings come from?
Yeah, I think certainly when you look at that move away from local brick manufacturers. So typically, if we look at London as an example, the famous London stock brick, this kind of slightly yellow brick that we see all around, particularly Georgian period in London, was formed from the brick earth of the capital itself in local kilns. The red brick that was imported was really almost an alien material, only from a couple of hundred kilometres away. But that removed, that dislocated the production of brick from something that was local to something that was remote. But it did remove us from this practical act of making.
So one of the things you mentioned in the chapter is that I think it's 95% of brick manufacturing is now consolidated with four suppliers in the UK. So what's the kind of implication of that?
Well, I think the implication is that we don't really see the manufacturer in our day-to-day lives unless we happen to live by one of the brick manufacturing plants that they run. There's about 60 main plants in the UK. They'll typically be 60 from the consolidated within a more limited ownership, as we've discussed. They'll typically still be located quite nearby the clay extraction. But yeah, the consolidation is really indicative of a lot of industrial production in that you can then make the investment to increase efficiency. But it does mean greater standardisation. So if we are looking at bricks that have a lower emissions and embodied carbon as a result of efficiency within the making, and that's particularly related to the kilning, because the high temperatures are where the vast majority of the emissions come from. You're going to get that benefit of efficiency if you stick to a standard range. If you start to introduce some variation, then you are likely to increase the emissions. And when it comes to something like the finish of a brick, it is actually quite relevant to the overall emissions. And we touch upon this in the chapter. Certain finishes, particularly surface finishes, can mean multiple firings. So you might have your main firing, which is where you're taking the raw clay that has been dried. You're firing it first to generate that ceramic vitreous structure, which gives us the durability. But then maybe you're cooling it again to apply a clay slip or some sort of material that then, when you refire, gives a surface variation. And that act can significantly increase the embodied carbon because you're heating, cooling, reheating. In some instances, the bricks that are coveted for a pleasing variation of surface finish may well be coal-fired rather than fired by a kiln using natural gas. And while there are ways that the emissions can be controlled and scrubbed, that will also have an impact on embodied carbon. So there are decisions to be made within the selection of the unit that impact on the final emissions.
So in one of our recent episodes, we spoke to Martha Lewis of Henning Larsen, and she's put together this database, which is open source on their website. She calls it Unboxing Carbon, where she looks at materials, and she does this in a workshop format and has studied a lot of EPDs. And for brick, she's got now 20 different bricks, just an image of the brick, the manufacturer, and an embodied carbon per meter squared number. And there is quite a range, as you're saying. So when a designer is trying to select a brick, how do you interpret those numbers? Is that going to have a big impact, that kind of range, if you have a whole facade and you go for, say, one of these bricks that's been fired twice?
It really can, yeah. I mean, the range is wide. It's a factor of maybe two or three. So, you know, the impact can be really significant. It's difficult to be really precise in the prediction of what the emissions will be. There are some principles, though, and I think it is important for us all to gain a bit more intuition as to the things that impact on embodied carbon and emissions. So if we start to hear about a high temperature process, that should give us an indication that there's going to be high emissions associated, because that will generally mean fossil fuels. But also, if we understand that there are these processes whereby we have to heat, cool, reheat, we can start to gain this intuition as to what might be a higher embodied carbon, what might not be so high. And things like, generally for a given clay, a hotter, longer firing will result in a stronger unit. So there is a somewhat of a correlation between something like strength, durability, and embodied carbon. But it's complicated by the fact that there's quite a lot of variation in the raw materials. So it isn't as simple, for example, to say that a darker brick will necessarily be higher emissions. For a given clay type, a hotter, longer firing will give you a darker brick. But if you start with a different clay to begin with, you'll get a different product. So it is difficult. Engagement with the manufacturers is really key still, always. And I think that's something that applies across all materials. To use the analogy with the chef, as designers, we need to understand far more about where our materials, our ingredients come from, and the provenance of that. Brick is no different. We do need to engage. Having said that, there are these simple correlations and metrics that we can hold in our mind to give us a bit of guide.
Intuitive rules of thumb.
I think it's really This intuition, I think, is something that's perhaps slowly developing in the industry, and they're having these kind of rules of thumb, like high temperature. You can hear that and think maybe it is fossil fuels. What about the other aspects of building using brick? We talked a bit previously when you wrote the chapter about mortar and fixings. How do they sit in that larger picture of the impact of bricks?
They're really, really important considerations. Fired brick units are maybe a little unusual in that they're necessarily part of a composite material, that they must sit within a mortar. And generally speaking, you want to make sure that there is a compatibility in the choice of unit and mortar. So the mortar, generally you want to be less strong than the brick to accommodate variation, allow for some movement, and generally to improve the long-term durability of the construction itself. So a really, really strong unit with a weak mortar is going to give you a low performance with respect to load carrying capacity. So you need to match, and that's particularly important when it comes to load-bearing masonry. And there is still a really significant portion of load-bearing masonry that we use in particularly house building, domestic scale architecture with cavity wall construction externally. The practice that we see more frequently within dense urban context of using brick as a facade material, as an envelope, a cladding, removes some of that load-bearing capacity, and we're now thinking more about durability and necessarily the aesthetics of that. And when you start moving away from the load-bearing applications to the cladding applications, how you then support the masonry is really, really important. So we find that if you look at a traditional kind of hand-laid facade system whereby you might have a shelf angle made in stainless steel that the brick is sat on, fixed back to a primary structure, maybe with some wind posts that provide lateral restraint, ties between the different skins, there's going to be as much embodied carbon in that support structure as there is in the brick and the mortar combined. But it's actually quite difficult often to estimate how much embodied carbon precisely will be in that support system. That there isn't a great deal of EPD information on that, on those support systems. It can even be quite tricky just to get the weight of the things. You can calculate that yourself, of course, with the geometry. So there's probably quite a lot of emissions that are being missed in things like the support structure. And even if you move to kind of strong back type panel where you have a material and a brick slip, you're still having quite a significant portion of embodied carbon in that support structure. And when we do the numbers on this, it can be comparable. It's really, really important that we factor those contributions in.
Does that mean we should be looking at other options for all these towers that are going up all over the place, other cladding materials?
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because one of the great benefits of brick masonry construction is that it has the potential to be incredibly long-lived if it's detailed in an appropriate way. So if we look at conventional load-bearing masonry facades, it's not unusual to see buildings that are 100 to 200 years old. Joe, we'll know from recent project work with Field and Clegg at Shrewsbury that we have a building there that is 250, moving into its third century, and it still has its, to a large extent, its original masonry facade. So they can be really, really long-lived. And when it comes to the embodied carbon associated with fired clay bricks, you really do need to look for that longevity. Because on a like-for-like comparison, if we take something very simple, I'm a structural engineer, so I'm interested in strength and stiffness when it comes to our structural designs. If you take the embodied carbon of a masonry construction using fired clay bricks and compare it on a unit stiffness or a unit strength basis to the other common materials, concrete, steel, timber, it doesn't compare particularly well, but it has this possibility to do more than one function. And it has this also this possibility to be incredibly long-lived. So we do need to aim for that. Whether we should be looking at alternatives, we should always be looking for alternatives. We should always be looking for opportunities to improve and reduce impact. But I don't think we necessarily need to write off brick as fired clay brick as a material without any benefit or potential for the future.
I think longevity is fantastic. I'm sitting at a Victorian terrace now, and it's still here, which is, you know, a testament. But what is it that makes, you know, what should the designer look for to make sure that their brick can last 150 years, 200 years, or, you know, coming into its third century as a Shrewsbury flax mill?
Yeah, the key thing with, and this actually applies to all construction materials, is we need to give the right level of protection within the detailing. There's an appropriate way of using materials and a non-appropriate way. It got me thinking that actually if you put steel in the wrong environment and you don't protect it, it becomes pretty soft pretty quickly. So when it comes to brick, it's no different. And really protecting it from water and then from the potential for freeze-thaw action, the expansion of frozen water can cause the face of bricks to spall and delaminate. It's about protecting from moisture, and it's the old adage, good hat, good boots. Right? So keep the masonry out of contact with water from the ground and, as far as possible, rainwater. So there's guidance out there that will, depending on your exposure, where you are in the country, this applies in the UK, but equally overseas and elsewhere, where you are, there'll be a recommendation of the minimum resistance for that brick. We choose the appropriate brick, and then we detail in a way to throw that water away from the facade. So you look at traditional detailing, and there will be large overhangs, there will be drips, sills, and we do still need to provide those things. And when we look around to modern uses of masonry, often the most successful are those that you don't necessarily copy directly, but use those principles from historic construction.
So what about the application we've talked about in cladding, but what about in volume house building, low-rise volume house building? What alternatives do you see there, or do you think brick will retain the dominance that it's had so far?
I think it probably will retain a certain amount of market share for reasons that we've touched upon already, to do with perception and
durability,
nostalgia, durability, proven track record, and so on. We don't necessarily have to stay with a fired clay brick, and actually if you move around, if we look at the UK as an example, if we move around the UK, we will find regions where brick is certainly dominant in the domestic architecture, but there are regions where we will see stone that is used because there wasn't the resource of clay that was needed for the fired bricks. And if we actually look at modern house building in the UK, if we move to Scotland, the load-bearing masonry that is dominant within England is replaced with more timber framing to reflect local availability, but also, should we say, the comfort that people have in that form of construction. I think we will continue to see a demand for load-bearing masonry within domestic architecture, for sure. But as I say, there are things that can be done, and we'll no doubt touch upon options for reducing the emissions associated with a brick unit. And then we could also look to think about replacing some of those units, whether they are clay masonry or whether that's reinforced concrete blocks, in internal applications with materials that don't need such high levels of durability. So we could even just take the dried, unfired clay that is being used as a facing brick, and if we use that internally within the building, where there isn't the requirement for enhanced durability, we have a way of reducing the emissions significantly.
What about circularity and brick reuse?
I feel like, without overstating, it's one of the superpowers of a brick in that you can reuse them, and there is a market for reclaimed bricks. One of the principal challenges is, we mentioned earlier that masonry is a composite material of a unit and mortar. One of the big challenges is removing that mortar. And as we've moved to mortars that are bound with ordinary Portland cement, the strength and the adhesion of that mortar is increased. So while, if we look back at historic construction, we would have had much weaker lime-bound mortars that were easier to remove, we now have a little bit more of a challenge in removing that mortar without damaging the units themselves. So the level of wastage is often higher with a modern masonry unit. Now, there is some really promising research looking at mechanised ways of removing even cement-bound mortars. So I think into the future, circularity probably is going to be focused more on the reuse of the unit itself. It isn't as frictionless as it would be in using a new unit, where all of those steps within manufacturing are seen and controlled and the tests are really well established and understood, but it is possible.
Because the amount of reclaimed bricks actually being used right now is tiny.
It's very
right?
small, yeah, it's very small.
Less than 5%.
Yeah, exactly. I think a lot of it is about that declaration. You know, how do you have the paperwork to do it? Do you see it simplifying anytime soon? Are there methods that are going to make this a bit easier?
I think the ease would come through just the development of the market, the providers that are able to respond. But, you know, the best reuse of masonry will be in situ. So if we can make sure that we're designing a building to be as long-lived as possible, then that the challenges surrounding ex-situ reuse are less of a concern.
So, interestingly, we talked a bit about this kind of increasing scale of construction within the UK during sort of the Victorian era. But actually, I just wonder how it varies globally. Obviously, you've spoken a lot about working in Europe and their kind of declaration of performance. How does it vary? Are bricks the same in the UK as abroad? I presume not. I presume energy mixes and materiality and the matrix that you use them in changes an awful lot. What's the kind of global situation of bricks?
Fundamentally, the kind of raw materials are very similar. There'll be an almost infinite subtle variation in the sources of clay, and you know you see that even within a small country like the UK. If you look at the regional differences in the colour of the brick, it's apparent. One thing we didn't mention earlier actually is that part of that Victorian explosion of bricks came from a particular type of brick called a fletton. But they generated a lot of emissions, and not just embodied carbon, but also particulates, kind of black carbon. And that really is one of the key concerns when it comes to looking at brick manufacture more globally. We mentioned the really quite efficient industrialised production that we might see in somewhere in places such as the UK, that generally going to be fired with natural gas. There'll be controls on the emissions that happen. If we look at more traditional brick manufacture, it is within still these intermittent temporary clamps, kilns, fired by charcoal, coal, wood, and there's no real control on what is coming out of that kiln, and it can generate significant amounts of particulates. So what we saw in the industrialisation of our cities in the UK 100, 150, 200 years ago, we see in other regions, and we have to be really, I think, mindful when it comes to the question of using brick in regions where intermittent kilns are still prevalent. What is the wider impact beyond simply just embodied carbon? So these particulates are really damaging to health. That's one of the things about brick, is that it is a global material and it is still used widely throughout the world for particularly domestic architecture. It is often the lowest cost material and is a material that straddles this local production, almost artisan production, through to industrial. It is still possible to make a brick at small scale in a way that you can't with something like steel or even ordinary Portland cement for concrete production. So it really is a material that has global relevance. And when we do have the opportunity to work in other markets, we should be really engaging with local practice to ensure that the impact is minimised and is as positive as possible.
I just came back from my first trip to India. I was in southern India near Trivandrum. I don't know if you've ever come across the work of British architect Laurie Baker. Very prolific, and studied a lot vernacular architecture and use of brick in southern India. And he did these incredible buildings, a lot of perforated brick screens.
It's one of the joys of brick architecture, isn't it? It's almost infinite. The possibility of such a simple unit, almost a letter within a whole language, or a series of letters within a language, the variation is just incredible for something
so simple.
It's
a very democratic material, as you're saying. The setup cost to make a brick are comparatively low. You don't need special things to handle it. You know, it's lightweight. You can pick up a couple at a time quite easily. So it's a very simple material.
That leads to my next question. So related, how do you see the future for making blocks out of excavated site material? Do you see that gaining momentum?
I think so. I mean, I really think we're at a point where there's such a renewed interest in construction materials more widely, but specifically when it comes to something like a brick or a block. The fact, as you touched upon, Joe, that it is a very democratic construction product that you can make with reasonably low setup costs means that there's quite a lot of potential for invention. And so when it comes to a clay-fired brick, the routes that are being investigated with respect to reducing the embodied carbon probably remain at the industrial scale to do with fuel switching and maybe eventually hydrogen firing and green hydrogen firing with all of the challenges that that brings. But for us, really interesting area is more in alternative binders and the use of, when we talk about circularity, the use of construction and demolition waste. And I say waste, but really we should be thinking of them as products or feedstocks. And we've been working on a number of projects with like-minded designers and material specialists to develop bricks using waste materials bound with conventional materials such as lime, which work very well, but still have challenges with respect to emissions, because we're still effectively burning limestone. So lime is one avenue that we've been looking at, but we're also really excited to be working for a number of years now with researchers at Imperial College who are spinning out into the Ceratec company. And people might associate Ceratec with concrete products, but one of the other materials that comes out of the process they've developed is magnesium carbonate. The process that they've developed at Ceratec presents this magnesium carbonate in a form that allows it to be used as a binder without high input of energy and curing at ambient temperatures. And we don't then also have the emissions associated with high temperature firing, because it isn't a ceramic route, it's a mineral bound route. And the really, really big positive of this material is that it's a form of mineral sequestration. So the process itself uses carbon dioxide as a feedstock. And so we could potentially have a future where the bricks that we see in our buildings are a form of sequestered CO2, a non-living way of capturing that CO2. So the equivalent of a forest, but in mineral form.
There's an elegance there, isn't there, that, you know, construction's been emitting carbon for years, but by building more, we might be able to help. Actually, there's something quite beautiful about that.
This gives me hope to hear this. Yeah,
and these processes are a geological, you know, the processes that we're talking about here have occurred in the natural world, but over geological timescales, and really the steps forward are being found in how to accelerate, but accelerate without the input of large amounts of energy, particularly fossil fuel energy. So I think we're seeing more and more that a lot of the interesting developments are in chemistry rather than in firing or, you know, high temperature processes.
There's a large academic change in chemistry departments around the globe, where for years it's been all about organic chemistry, you know, it's based on fossil materials, and now it's inorganic chemistry. There's a huge scaling up all of a sudden in academia, which then has to transfer into industry, which has to transfer into designers. So it's actually the fundamentals of our understanding of chemistry has to sort of shift. It's a really exciting period.
I love it when talking to the researchers and they say, well, we're just wondering, why has nobody else thought of it before? And it probably touches upon your point, Joe, that we weren't necessarily looking. And so there's this period of real excitement in that there's opportunities, and it broadens the palette of potential. And as that then manifests itself through design, it becomes almost infinite in what can be done. It's quite exciting.
I want to ask you a bit of a broader question. I think one of the main messages of our book is using the right amount of the right material in the right place. And obviously that's a very tricky thing to navigate with clients and make decisions on a particular project, even incorporating some of these innovations that you're describing. So how do you approach this decision-making on a project?
In my mind personally, and I think also in the work that we do it in the office at AKT too, we see that the future is about a plurality of materials and solutions, as you say, used in the right place and in the right way, not a single silver bullet. And so as designers, we need to be comfortable in being able to work and design with a whole range of materials. And that, I think, means that we have to take things back a little bit more to first principles, to try to rebuild some of that intuition and understanding of what we're asking of our design, what we're asking of our material, and which of the materials provide that to a greater or lesser extent. We didn't mention in great detail when we were looking to future innovations. One of the simplest kind of future innovations is not to use a fired clay brick, but to use an unfired clay brick. And that really isn't, from a design point of view, a massive step, certainly not for a structural engineer. But the trepidation that you feel when you talk about the design within using an unfired clay brick is really palpable, and it doesn't need to be. And that extends beyond architects, engineers, and the designers into those that work more widely within the construction industry, project teams, those that enable projects, that fund projects, the clients, contractors, the people who are building, that we need to expand the horizon and get back to a scenario where we are able to pick and choose the right material for the right job. But the only way to navigate it is to bring it back to those fundamental questions of performance and the first principles, and build up from there. And look for lower risk applications to begin with. Look for projects where the risk can be shared amongst all of those that are involved. And that will mean that probably in the first instance the applications are a little smaller. But if we've done our thinking and homework in the background to check that there is a route to a larger scale application, it shouldn't matter too much that we start reasonably small.
Thinking about materials and scale, we spoke to even McNamara and we talked about the sort of prevalence of concrete. I know AKT2 have joined Concrete Zero, which is setting out specific targets for decarbonisation, so low carbon concrete by 2025 and 100% net zero by 2050, which is ambitious and exciting. What is low emission concrete, and how realistic do you think these targets are? Are we going to be able to meet them in our projects? Is it UK? Is it global?
When it comes to the Concrete Zero commitment, which is for a low carbon concrete at a certain percentage by a certain time, so 30% of our concrete specified achieving this low carbon threshold, is it possible to achieve that now? The answer is yes. On an individual basis, at a project basis, the answer is yes. And actually, even at an industry scale, you could see it happening. But the main lever that it draws upon at the moment is GGBS. But it uses this constrained supplementary cementitious material that comes from steelmaking. So if you look at that 30% commitment to achieve a low carbon concrete according to the current definition, you need to specify in an individual concrete about 50% GGBS. So if you have 50% GGBS in 30% of your mixes, your overall concrete is using about 15% GGBS. So you've met the first commitment and you've generally conformed to the overall availability of GGBS at a global scale. But what does that then mean looking into the future, the slightly more complex question? Well, the available supply of these constrained SCMs that come from industrial processes, it's not going to increase significantly into the future. So we need to look for other opportunities. And one of the things that we are particularly interested in is looking at the reduction of the amount of binder that we demand. And a lot of that can come from design. So using less material for the same function. I use this example, I think it's a little bit naive, but it's an interesting example that the last bike that I bought, I'm an avid cyclist, cost twice as much as my old bike, but it weighed 2 kilograms less. So I wasn't buying stuff, I was buying performance. And I think that's how we need to approach buildings again. We need to think about performance rather than just material. For a long time, this age of abundance and abundant energy, abundant material has allowed us to pursue solutions that are efficient when it comes to labour, time on site, programme. So something like a flat slab construction in concrete isn't the most efficient way of forming a structure when you look at material. It has its benefits in terms of reduced floor to ceiling or reduced floor zone, so you increase your floor to ceiling heights and is quite easy to construct, but it uses more material than is necessary. So we should think about such simple things as ribbed slabs and coffered slabs and trough slabs, the things that we saw in the post-war years where material was less available. So using less material overall, using form-effective structures, we should really be looking at that again, engaging with contractors, looking for the reality of what this means in terms of program on site, additional cost because of the forms and so on. The preconceived view on a lot of these structural types is almost certainly outdated because we haven't really interrogated it again in detail for 20, 30 years. Even something as simple as just how long you prop a slab for. If you prop that slab for a little bit longer or you slightly change the way that you stress it if it's a PT, you can reduce the amount of binder. So that's the other big area that we're trying to look at, is how do we optimise the use of the binder, the cement within the concrete? Because there are things that we can do right now that vastly reduce the amount of binder. Some of that needs complementary solutions within design. Some of it is about working really closely with concrete producers to optimise the mixed designs. So it isn't just as simple as there's going to be an SCM, a supplementary cementitious material that appears and it solves all of our problems. It's more complex than that. Mm. So.
There's a lot of talk about hybrid structures now. Do you see that as an important potential way forward?
Absolutely. I think pretty much every structure, every building that we produce is a hybrid of sorts, because each material has its relative benefits and downsides. So hybrids are great, a great way of thinking as well. When we look at the design for their original intended purpose, there's often benefit when it comes to using materials together, particularly structurally, and getting them bound as tightly as possible or fixed together so that they can work together. But if it doesn't compromise the construction to allow those materials to be removed and separated in the future, we should do that. Also, and that's really important when it comes to things like envelopes and facades, I think, because while the bones of a structure, there's no reason why they can't be kept beyond their original intended service life, 50, 100, 150, 200 years. When it comes to aspects of envelope, there will be a certain amount of maintenance, repair, updating that is required, whether that is just through general wear and tear over time, the action of the environment, whether it is in response to climate change, whether it's in response to increasing thermal performance, that there's going to be alteration required. And so we do need to think about how the materials are pulled apart again in something like a facade or an envelope so that they can be repurposed, reused, reconditioned. When it comes to a structure, I think our view is that it's maybe less of a principal focus. But if we can do it, let's do it. And it's a great way of achieving material efficiency by using the material in the right place.
One of the things we touched on very briefly was education. What teaching are you doing now?
We try to be involved in as much research work, but also teaching as we can be, because there's this amazing opportunity to seek new ways of doing things. Personally, my kind of principal involvement at the moment is with GSD at Harvard, working with one of our founding principals, Hanif. And our main focus over the past few years has been looking at the role of material selection, material production, material selection, how that transitions and manifests itself into building design. So this year we've been running a studio looking at structural stone application for medium rise buildings. I also have kind of ad hoc involvement with University of East London, for example, where we've been working there with researchers looking at a material that they've developed called sugarcrete, which uses a co-product, a waste product currently from sugarcane manufacture, bagasse, in making that into a great way of sequestering very large amounts of carbon. We've also been looking more widely at bamboo, particularly laminated bamboo. I think you could say that our interest is broad, but quite focused on engineered products when it comes to the biogenic side of things, something that can slot in quite easily and replace the conventional materials.
What are you most excited about that's in the pipeline at the moment?
I think we touched upon it very briefly, but it seems like there's this opportunity for what we call form-effective design again. Views the structure as part of the overall architectural expression of a building. From a materials point of view, I think there's some really exciting things coming through on the biogenic side. And this whole world of chemistry, as you mentioned, Joe, that's opening up. So, yeah, there's a lot that's positive.
Well, thank you. That's a great place to stop. Thank you very much, David. So much food for thought in that conversation.
Super. And thanks very much, Atty and Joe, for inviting me. I'm sure that we'll be able to provide some contact details in the show information. And if anybody does want to reach out and discuss anything that we've touched upon or more widely, then always happy to do that.
I suspect you'll have a busy inbox.
Our next guest will be Sean Ricketts of Carmody Gwork Architects, talking about a prototype brick developed for the Ghent Design Museum in Belgium. You can find the show notes for this episode at www.architectsjournal.co.uk/podcasts, where you can also catch up with all our previous episodes. If you're enjoying Climate Champions, please subscribe and do rate us on your favorite podcast platform. It helps people find us. Thanks.